So this is our last full day at the ashram, and we'll finish up our text today in this session and then the session at night. The session at night is going to be a little heavy, especially for people who haven't been exposed to what they call emptiness, the idea of emptiness. So get a good dinner and... take some amphetamines. So there's a number of people who are just joining us today, so we'll do a rather quick review because we have a lot of stuff to cover. But this is this is a weekend where we have a chance to review the steps on the path, the spiritual path. What is a spiritual path, and what does it consist of? And it's one thing to go to teachings, spiritual teachings, and hear about this or that. It's another thing to figure out how everything goes together. And that's the beauty of what they call the Lam Rim in Tibetan, steps on the path, the Lam Rim, because it shows you like how to go from A to Z in your spiritual life. So the beginning of any spiritual life is turning away from the non-spiritual life, right? That means what they call renunciation, which is a kind of a scary sounding word. It doesn't mean that you have to give up all your money. It doesn't mean that you have to cut off all your hair. It doesn't mean you have to put on like funny clothes and live in a cave somewhere. It certainly doesn't mean that. That's not renunciation. That's that's at best the physical representation. The real renunciation is mental. Renunciation means turning away from suffering and the causes of suffering, and saying, I want to be happy. I don't want to waste another day of this precious life, precious and short life, being miserable and not knowing why and not knowing how to be anything other than miserable. So renunciation means turning away from the sources of suffering. And the sources of suffering really are, can be summed up as attachment. Attachment, or grasping is another term they often use, clinging sometimes. And that means like grasping on to things that are impermanent and changing. Is your job a permanent thing or an impermanent thing? Changing or unchanging? Is your money, your bank account, a changing thing or an unchanging thing? Are your relationships changing things or unchanging things? You see, and then we grasp onto changing things as if they wouldn't change, and then are disappointed when they do. Often taken by surprise, often shocked, actually. Is your body a changing thing or an unchanging thing? It's a very changing thing. So as opposed to just ordinary changing things, the body's a very changing thing. Yeah, and then, people find themselves, getting older or they lose their health or something. How could this have happened? How could this have ever happened? Well, they've been attached to the idea that the body is an unchanging thing and that youth would last forever and that health would last forever and so forth. And then, reality shows itself to you. You can't fool reality. You can fool yourself about reality, but you can't fool reality. So, reality is one of our greatest teachers. When things change, when things like show themselves for what they always were, which is a changing thing, then if you're unhappy about that or if you're stressed out about that, that just means that you have attached to a false idea that the changing thing wouldn't change somehow. Is your car a changing thing or an unchanging thing? So you buy a new car, and nowadays, they've got these cars, they just push button, you don't even have to have a key, and they've got the GPS talking to you, and they've got cameras so you don't have to go like this, because that's awfully hard to do, to put it in reverse and actually have to, crank your head around. And you take your car home, and your brand new car, and you say, I just love my new car, so nice, so great. And, then it changes. And you press the button and it starts, press the button and it starts, press the button and it starts. And one day you're going to press the button and what's going to happen? Not going to start. And you go, oh, I'm having such a bad day. My car doesn't start. Well, what did you think? did you think your car would always start? And the answer to that is yes. Yes, I did. I spent a lot of money on this car, and I expected it to start forever. And that's the case with everything. That's the case with everything in life. So anytime we attach, if we attach to things as if they wouldn't change, we try to grasp onto them to arrest change, we are setting ourselves up for suffering. For sure. I mean, not maybe, but for sure, you see? See, just like your car, you know, one day your car won't start up. One day your computer, your brand new, like, cool Mac, you know, Air computer. One day it won't boot up either, right? You know, and then my computer, I'm having really, really stressed out today because my computer didn't boot up. Well, welcome to life. One day you won't boot up either. You see, because, you know, you're a changing thing. One day your relationships won't boot up. One day your loved ones won't boot up. You see, everything is in the nature of change. This is kind of like the elementary falling of the scales from the eyes, is to realize that all the baskets that we put all our eggs in are liable to fall, and the eggs break at any time. And so then you go like, well, where can I go for something that will last, for something that won't just be a temporary pleasure spike before it becomes another source of suffering? And well, maybe the spiritual life has something to say about that. The spiritual life is about, you know, I often say this in groups like this. You know, I have nothing new to say, actually. You know, teachers of spirituality have no new, there's no noobs here, only olds. Yeah? I mean, you know, these are traditions that go back thousands and thousands of years on how to live a happy life. Time-tested, right? And so there's, you know, it's... We live in a time where we always want to find something new all the time. You know, new stuff and new information and new cars and new this and new that. And spiritual life is not new. These kinds of advices, these kinds of ways of living and so forth are ancient. I mean, thousands of years long. And so, you know, presumably people have tried it out for the course of thousands of years and found it to work. I mean, if they didn't, you know, like, why do we think that, like, you know, at some point, if these things didn't work, at some point somebody would have, like, raised their hand and said, you know, this doesn't work. Let's try something different. You know, but they didn't. They continue. So with that kind of realization, that kind of recognition that there may be something, you know, kind of useful and beneficial and time-tested in the spiritual traditions, we turn away from our 100% attention to the non-spiritual life. You know, it doesn't have to be like a whole big thing. You know, you still have to go to work. You still have to raise your family. You still maybe want to buy a new car once in a while. Nothing wrong with that. But to put all of your attention, all of your sort of energy into those kinds of endeavors is just a way of continuing to suffer without any alternative. So with that recognition, then you start a spiritual life. And the first thing you do is find somebody who can teach you. So if you look at your addendum, for those, especially those people who are just coming, the addendum is a little bit of a summary of the whole workshop, actually. And we'll go through the parts that we've been through already quickly and just review it for you. So relying on the teacher, number one, means finding someone who you think can teach you how to live a good life, a happy life, a life that isn't just subject to the vicissitudes, the ups and downs, the roller coaster ride of what they call samsara, the cycle of suffering over and over and over again. And the point here is not, okay, I emphasize this very strongly, is not some kind of cult of personality. It's not about some person. It's about what that person can teach you, you see? Just like if you're interested in learning piano, it doesn't matter if the person who teaches you piano is a man or a woman, if they're blonde or brunette, you know, if they're ugly or beautiful. What matters is that do they know, like, something about piano and how to teach it to you, you see? So it's very, very dangerous to to think that this business of relying on the teacher means relying on a personality. It's relying on someone who knows something that you want to know. And then you have respect. You generate some respect, not for the personality, but for the information, for the teachings, and of course the vehicle that is bringing you the teachings. And as I mentioned before, in our day and age, it's very, very unlikely, maybe impossible, that if you go down a spiritual path, there will be only one teacher. You will have many different kinds of teachers teaching you various kinds of things. You'll have people teaching you yoga. You'll have other people teaching you meditation. You'll have other people teaching you from the texts, from the spiritual texts. You'll have many, many people teaching you from many different kinds of texts, maybe. You know, you can go on YouTube and get all kinds of teachings. And go on the internet and find all kinds of teachings. So we are in an amazing kind of time and place where we have access to a variety and a multitude of teachers and teachings. And that's just the case. In the old days, it wasn't like that. In the old days, you would be lucky to find one, you know, because they weren't like thick on the ground, and there was no internet, and there was no, you know, printing presses, and there were no like CDs and DVDs and all of that. So it's not about some kind of obsession with a person. It's a respect for the vehicle, and especially for what that vehicle can deliver to you. So then with that kind of respect, you become a good student. And you become a student. Good student is defined by three principles. You remember what they are? So the people who are actually here. Open-mindedness, first and foremost. Open-mindedness means like you have a sense that you don't know everything already and that you could learn something, you see? And without that open-mindedness, you're never going to learn anything. Then what's the second one?
Intelligence.
Which doesn't mean that you score high on an IQ test or that you get all A's at the uni. It means that you have the skill set, the mental skill set to be discerning, to like think for yourself and to think, is what I'm learning, is what I'm hearing useful or not? You see? To have that critical awareness. A good student always has that critical awareness. It is up to the student to have that critical awareness. And again, we've run into all kinds of problems of students coming into the teacher-student relationship without that critical awareness and just saying, well, whatever, you know, fill me up. I'll just be an empty vessel and you fill me up with all kind of, you know, all that wisdom that you have and I won't think about it at all. I won't like evaluate it or interpret it or like see how it's useful to me or not. So that's another very important aspect of a good student. And then the third one, conscientiousness. Conscientiousness. You know what I mean? Being conscientious about putting it into practice. You know, the information that you get at a retreat like this is not like the information that you're getting on the internet every day or on television shows or on the radio, you see, which we have learned to filter, right? In fact, it's not even filtered, really. It goes in and then right out again, isn't it? You know, we can't hold it all in our brains. It's coming in, it's so fast and so, you know, and with such quantity. So we have to kind of retrain ourselves when we come to a spiritual you know, retreat or a teaching like that, to not just, you know, flip on that same switch and to have it go in one ear and out the other and you leave on Sunday and forget all about it, which is kind of how we handle all the rest of our information flow in our lives. So conscientiousness means you spend a weekend like this, you take notes, you listen, you discern with your discernment, you think about, like, you know, what's useful about what I've heard and what isn't, and then on Sunday night, as you go enter your home, you start to practice it. You start to put it into practice. Otherwise, it's just another 4 days of your life gone. Just another 4 days less that you have to live. So, you know, we'll talk about this again tomorrow, I think. You know, what can you take back to Melbourne or wherever you're going, Portland? What can you take back from this retreat that will actually help you live a better life? Because otherwise, it's just a waste of time. Really a waste of time. Waste of time and energy. Just another infotainment. It's probably like not the best infotainment show that you've ever saw. You know, there's probably a lot better ones in Melbourne right now, you know. Just, you know, go to some comedy show or to a movie or something like that. It'd probably be more entertaining than this. Even with kirtan, you know. It's probably still probably more entertaining. But that's not the point. The point isn't to entertain you. The point is to transform you. The point is to make you a better person, a happier person, a better person for yourself and for the people around you. And hopefully you've heard something over the course of this weekend that will do that for you. And then it's up to you, you see. We're not going to follow you home, you know, with a little clipboard going, you know, did they actually put it into practice? You know, we're all grown-ups here, right? So it's up to you. It's up to you. What to make a retreat like this worthwhile to yourself by making some changes in your life. So you find a teacher, you become a good student, you listen well, you discern, you use your critical judgment, and then you put it into practice. And one of the things that you definitely have heard this weekend is the next thing on the list here, that you are living an incredible life. You have all kinds of things going for you here. You've got your, you know, prosperity, you've got your time, leisure time. You're not in some rice paddy working 16 hours a day for like $2, you see? You know, not living a life like billions of people on this planet are. Highly educated, have access to all kinds of spiritual materials, have no, like, mental defects, see? You know, like, born with a pretty good mind, not retarded or, you know, unable to understand the words that are coming out of my mouth. All kinds of things that you, obstacles that you're free from and opportunities that you have. Okay? That's leisure and fortune. And to space out on that day after day after day after day is to really waste life, to really waste the kind of gift that we have been given to have a life like this. Very, very rare. So with a life like this, we also have responsibilities, you know, to have the kind of advantages that we have also requires that we assume the responsibilities that go with that, which is to, like, do something useful with it and not just consume it, not just sit around, you know, like playing games and going to, you know, endless, you know, restaurants and having endless lattes. But to, you know, like, do something useful with the opportunities that we have. Then the next one, steps shared with those of lesser capacity. You remember the definition of a practitioner like this. Somebody who's interested by whatever means. It says kind of strong in the Sanskrit. By whatever means. Someone who's interested in being happy in this life. Learning how to be happy in this life for themselves. You see? And that's the foundational. That's the foundational level of a spiritual life. Is that you decide you don't want to be unhappy the rest of your life. And to figure out then the methods for achieving happiness. One of which is to recognize that you don't have infinite time to get her done. To get the job done of living a happy life in this life. You don't have infinite time. So the death awareness thing, that's the first kind of subset of the steps shared with those of foundational scope. Let's call it that. That's better. Because it's the foundation for any spiritual practice. Foundation. It's like, well, what about, you know, do I want to be happy or not? And also to realize as a kind of a corollary to that, that you can't help anyone else be happy unless you figured out how to do it yourself. So there is kind of an obligation to others inherent in the sort of decision that you're going to figure out how to be happy in your own life. So the first thing is to recognize that time is running out, okay? So we did a three-part, and I don't know if you did more than three parts. Did you do a meditation, death awareness meditation today?
Yeah, no, we did it in my review.
Oh, yeah, in the review class, yeah. Yeah, so Cindy did a little more elaborate version of it yesterday. The three parts are, it's three simple parts. Your death is certain, also known as my death, you know, when you're saying it to yourself. My death is certain. The time of my death is totally uncertain. Nobody can give you any guarantees about when it is you're going to die, not even Dr. Ian. Dr. Ian can, like, do a kind of a whole physical exam on you and say, yep, clean bill of health for you. You walk out of Dr. Yin's, you know, office and you get hit by a truck. No, that can happen. That doesn't just happen to other people, you see. It's not just other people that stuff like that can happen to, you see. It can happen to anyone. So the second thing is to recognize that death is totally uncertain. And the third thing is to think about, well, what is really going to matter when it comes time to die? Death is the only thing that we know for sure is going to happen, so we should think about it a little bit and prepare ourselves for it on a kind of a day-to-day basis. Every day that we have to live is a gift, another gift, and to stop squandering our lives, you know, uselessly, and most importantly, stop postponing. What's it called? Procrastinating. All the time procrastinating. Well, I'll get to that later. You know, oh, this all sounds good here at the ashram, especially when I'm around all these, like, spiritual people, and you sort of get this, like, kind of, like, groupthink, and yeah. But you know, next week I've got a big thing coming up, you know. I got a big deal at work, and I got to prepare for that, and, you know, I got, like, this other thing to do, and, you know. But, you know, soon, I'm going to clear time and really, you know, get down to it. Meditate and do yoga and that. Maybe next summer I'll do that. Maybe then. See? That's the endless, and that process is endless, potentially endless. Always procrastinate. Because we assume we always have more time. Because we just assume that, you know, of course, I'm going to die, but not for a really long time. No. You know, right? Everyone thinks that. It doesn't take much to convince people that they're going to die. Although, you know, there's plenty of blockages to that. But, you know, it's kind of obvious. I mean, you have to be really out to lunch, you know, to not realize that, you know, you're mortal. But then the next thing immediately that comes up is, but not anytime soon. You know, the older you get, the harder it is to maintain that thought. But it's still, even old people, you manage to, you know, well, I'm pretty old now, but I should at least have the, you know, the average. And the average now is, what, in the 80s or something like that? That average lifespan's in the 80s, I think, isn't it? Yeah, so I'm at least average. I should be more than average, actually, because I've lived such a good life. you know? And there is no average lifespan for any individual. Okay? No individual has an average lifespan. I started losing my friends when they were 15. I had a friend who was 15 who was murdered. He never got close to the average lifespan when you die at 15. You know, I've had plenty of people in my life, close people, friends and family members, who never made it anywhere near the average lifespan. And I'm sure you have too. And that's not aberrant or something, you know. That's not like some unique thing that happens to, like, you know, just some people who definitely are not me. You see, it could happen to me too. It could happen to you too at any time. So what's going to really matter? Then you get motivated a little bit. You see, if you do, that's a very, very powerful meditation. If there's nothing else that you take away from this weekend, take that one away. And start doing that on a pretty much of a daily basis. It is not morbid. It is not about morbidity. It's about like inspiration. It's about like appreciation for every new day that you have. And every new day is a, you know, like New Year's. Every day is New Year's. Every day is a chance for a new beginning. And so take advantage of that. The next one is sufferings of the lower realms. You know, well, we don't know what's going to happen to us after death. We don't know. So it would be a good idea, as I said yesterday, to hedge your bets. You know, since we don't know if there's an afterlife, it would be a good idea to live a good life in this life just in case. Right? I mean, if you can't think of any other reason to live a good life, you know, just in case, there's, you know, all these stories about hells and, you know, damnation and punishment. You know, who knows? Maybe there's something to it. Maybe there's something to the whole concept of rebirth. And that if you don't create the causes for a good or better rebirth, then you get a worse rebirth. And there are plenty of worse rebirths than the ones that we have. Plenty of them, right? beginning with different kinds of ways to be a human. If, you know, in the text they say, you're really lucky if you're a human at all, compared to all the other life forms that you could take. So, you know, and then there's like gradations of what kind of human birth you can get, and guess who's got like about the best one you could ever get? You. So, like, why do we assume that, well, you know, even if we believe in rebirth or even have some kind of, you know, small suspicion that there might be rebirth, why would we assume that we would automatically be, you know, have a life like this again? You know, there used to be, maybe there's still this thing, past life regression. Is that still a thing? Where people will say, like, okay, now go back, and then, you know, go back to when you're in the womb, and then go back further into your past life. And, you know, everyone turns out to be Cleopatra. you know, or Napoleon, or, like, you know, somebody really famous and important. Nobody, like, goes back, oh, yeah, I'm a serf, you know, in the mud, you know, in the Middle Ages, you know. Right? We always assume that, you know, that if there is past and future lives, that we'll be just kind of on top, just like we are now. So you don't have to assume that. All right, so third one is going for refuge, thinking about what it is that can help you live a good life, protect you from the possibilities that there may be of the consequences of not living a good life. And the traditional ones in this system are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Buddha means the paradigmatic figures of your spiritual imagination. You know? Might be Jesus, might be Mahatma Gandhi, might be the Dalai Lama, but whoever it is, you go for refuge to them and, like, you know, you think about how awesome they are and think, gosh, I'd like to be like that. I'd like to be like the Dalai Lama. I'd like to try to be like the Dalai Lama, live my life like that. Take refuge. Take refuge in the Dharma. Take refuge in the teachings. In the teachings, in the many forms that the teachings come in, formal teachings, written teachings, teachings from various kinds of traditions that are helping you learn how to live a good life. That's refuge. And then taking refuge in the Sangha, in the community of like-minded believers, like-minded people, not believers in the sense that everyone's carrying the same identity card. I'm a Buddhist, you're not a Buddhist, so I can't hang out with you. But people who are inspiring to you and people who bring out the best in you, okay, take refuge in that. Then the last one is generating belief in the laws of karma. Laws of karma are very simple to understand. The first law of karma is nothing goes for naught. No action, no word, no thought just disappears into the vapor. We live in a world of causality, cause and effect. Every thought, every action, every word, every speech act is a cause for a future effect. And to have some faith in that. If you don't have faith in that, then nothing really matters. You see what I mean? Doesn't matter what you do. Doesn't matter what you say. Doesn't matter what you think. If there aren't consequences. So you can think about that. Every action of body, speech, and mind has a consequence. And the consequence or the effect has to resemble the cause. Okay? So if the cause is selfless, loving, altruistic, caring about someone else other than yourself, then the effect must be similar, must be a pleasant effect. If the cause is the opposite of that, selfish, you know, self-centered, hurtful to others and so forth, then the effect will be similar. Your effect, the effect on you will be similar. What goes around comes around. It's a, you know, karma is a universal spiritual principle. There is no authentic spiritual tradition that doesn't have some version of this. Jesus said, you shall reap what you sow. And you go, reap, so what? I live in the city. What does that mean? Sowing at the tailor, or what? The seeds that you plant will determine the crops that you get. The cause that you put into place will determine the effects that you receive. And to have some belief in that is elemental, actually. So we're talking still about foundational stuff here. Foundational to a spiritual life. Without that, then when it's inconvenient, then we won't do what we know is the right thing because we think we can get away with it. As long as nobody finds out, you know, behind like some motel room door, you know, as long as nobody like catches you, then somehow you could get away with it. Well, Mr. Karma says you don't get away with nothing. Nothing goes unrewarded and nothing goes unpunished. The karma cam, you know, those camera things, the karma cam is always on. You know, you can go hide in some room somewhere, the karma cam is on because it's your own consciousness. It's your own awareness. You are planting seeds in your own awareness. It's not like some guy on Alpha Centauri is keeping track of it on with supercomputers. You know, enter. Oh, yeah, she did that. Enter. It's in your own mind. It's all happening in your own mind. Then there's steps shared with those of medium capacity. The medium capacity folks are the ones who say, in addition to not wanting to suffer in this life, I don't want to suffer in any life. Okay? I've realized that there is no place in this kind of with this kind of consciousness that I have, ordinary kind of consciousness, there's no life that I could have that doesn't involve some kind of suffering. The best possible, you know, life, the richest, the most famous people, the ones that have everything seeming to go, they still suffer too. There's no place in what they call samsara where there isn't suffering. Even in the heavens, they say, in the, you know, pleasure realms. The pleasure realm beings, they have a great life, they have no worries and so forth, but they still have suffering. The suffering comes at the end, where the karma wears out, and it's very interesting, kind of mythologically. They start to smell bad for the first time. These like devas, these gods, these pleasure beings, and all the other gods and devas, they don't want to hang out with you anymore because you start to stink. It's like having, you get like end-of-life body odor. And like nobody wants to hang out with you, and then their garlands start to wilt. So, oh, what's wrong with Joe? You know, his garland's wilting and he stinks. And then they, like I told you, then they have this vision of what's coming next after they've used up all the merit, all the good karma. What's going to happen next in the next life? And they freak out. So there's no place, see, there's no place in this kind of life with this kind of mindset that doesn't involve suffering. So you get clear on that, and then you figure, well, how can I escape suffering altogether? How can I escape karma altogether? Karma, which is the endless kind of cycle of cause and effect, which means that you've got to be there for the effect of the cause. See, as long as we keep putting causes into place, we have to be there to receive the effects. So that's kind of another way of talking about the cycle. The cycle of suffering, the cycle of rebirth and suffering over and over and over again. How to break out of that and be free. And then they talk about, well, the three trainings. The first one's ethics. Again, always ethics. Live a good life. Don't hurt other people. And at this stage also, ethics also means try to act in a less self-centered way. Try to act in a way where you realize that the actor, as Swami Atma was saying last night, that the actor is an illusion anyway. That there actually isn't an actor, there's just action. The idea that there's an actor is what they call grasping to self. Grasping to an illusion that we call the self. So later on tonight we'll talk a little bit about this. The self as illusion. Or you could say the self as merely an idea. When you go looking for the self, you can't find it. When you go try to find the self in the body or in the mind, when you try to find what we think of as ourselves, it's unfindable. It's elusive. That's because it's not there. It's just an idea. So the ethical life is informed by that fact that there isn't really an actor at all. Then meditative concentration. Learning how to concentrate your mind one-pointedly. We were just talking to someone this morning about the interest nowadays, widespread interest in what they call mindfulness. Well, why is that? Why is everyone so interested in mindfulness? It's because we've gotten used to mindlessness. We're so scattered all the time, bombarded by information, bombarded by diversion, can't keep a universalization of ADD, of attention disorder, deficit disorder. Everyone's got it, not just a few people now. We all got it. We can't keep our minds on anything anymore. So in kind of response to that, well, there's kind of a recognition that there's a problem here. And in response to that, everyone's like, well, what about mindfulness and meditation? It's the new yoga. And will become a multi-million dollar industry. I guarantee it. Already becoming that. Because, you know, everyone recognizes the need for it. So meditative concentration means learning how to put your mind one-pointedly on a beneficial object. And the most beneficial object is the third of what they call the extraordinary trainings of the steps shared with those of medium capacity. And that is wisdom. Penetrating the illusion of self, the illusion of separation, the illusion of things appearing, of being as they appear to be. They cannot be that way. And again, tonight I'll tell you why. Why they can't be the way they appear, but they simply can't. So once you get that, then you when you put a permanent end, when you cease to recreate the problems, recreate the suffering, when there's a cessation of what they call karma and klesha. Karma means action which requires a reaction. And klesha means mental afflictions, which drive our actions. When you put an end to that, then you achieve the state called nirvana. Nirvana, permanent peace. Individual peace. Sometimes they put it like that. Individual permanent peace. The steps shared with those of greater capacity, which we started on yesterday, is defined by the idea, the motivation on the part of the practitioner that just as I want peace, just as I want happiness, so too do all other beings. And it's not right for me to take, you know, mine without worrying about what the problems that other people have. Hmm? So this is the idea of identifying with all beings and bringing all and pledging to bring all beings into the enlightened state, the awakened state that you yourself want, because you are not different. So in a way, you could say these steps shared with those of greater capacity demands as a precondition the recognition that we are all exactly alike, fundamentally exactly alike. There's two ways that they say we're fundamentally exactly alike. You know, beneath all our differences in the way that we look physically, differences in our abilities, you know, differences in our intelligence, all the sort of relatively superficial differences, there are two commonalities that unite us, absolutely. Number one, all beings, not just human beings, all beings do not want to suffer. Just like you don't want to suffer, no other being wants to suffer. That is a universal feature, the great democracy. Then secondly, all beings want to be happy. They want not to suffer, and they want to be happy, just like you. So this is called the equalizing self with others. Equalizing, understanding that the great equality stretches out over all living beings, and you're not special. Or you could say you are special in the same exact way that everyone else is special, which doesn't mean that you're special at all, actually. Okay? So it's getting over this kind of idea of specialness, of individuality, of the individual personality as being somehow set apart from other beings in some kind of way. So that's the beginning of the greater scope. You see, it's greater because it's more expansive, more inclusive. It's a radical re-identification of who you are, a radical expansion of your identity into all living beings. So the first part of this, you know, that follows from this kind of motivation, this kind of like, you know, sort of mindset, is to develop that into a strong kind of a mentality called developing the wish for enlightenment. So we talked about that last night. Talked about what that means. Bodhicitta, right? The wish for enlightenment. The mindset. Citta means mindset of awakening. Bodhi means awakening in the present participle. It hasn't awakened fully. But it's awakening. Awakening to what? Awakening to the illusion of separation. Awakening to the illusion that we aren't all fundamentally the same. Awakening to the fact that my identity is a cosmic identity, ultimately. That there is only one identity. All living beings have the same identity. And therefore, all living beings not only have the desire to be free from suffering and to be happy, but have the right to be, the fundamental right to be. And to, like, dedicate your life to that. Dedicate your life to not only your own personal happiness, or even your own personal ultimate happiness, nirvana, but to develop your, to dedicate your life to the ultimate happiness of all living beings because you've identified with all living beings. So I think that's where we left off. Let's pick up the text again. We're on page, I didn't number these pages, did I? On verse 19, right? Is it? Is that where we left off? We left off at the end of 18, I think. Verse 18. 17. 17, that's right. So we're on 18. Okay, everyone with me? Where am I? How can you be with me? No, we're on 18, right? When the aspiring wish to awaken. So remember, there's two kinds of wishes here. Two kinds of bodhicitta. Page 12? Five. So there's two kinds of this wish to awaken, aspiring and activated. The difference, remember, the difference is aspiring is like wanting to come to the ashram and like planning on it and thinking about it and trying to like figure out how to get the time and the money and all like that. Oh, the activated wish to awakening is actually going there, actually like getting on the road and coming. When the aspiring wish to awaken arises, one should make efforts to strengthen it. So even in this kind of like, I wish someday I could have this incredibly cosmic, expansive, all-inclusive, you know, sense of connection to all beings, and the wish that all of us together become awakened. Even just that wish should be like, you know, reinforced over and over and over again. Even just that aspiring wish. Should make efforts to strengthen it. In order to remember it through all your future lives, protect the teachings which have been given to you. So you remember, like, what happened on, you know, Saturday afternoon at the ashram, what they were talking about over and over and over again. You bring it to mind over and over again. How nice that would be to no longer feel separate, to no longer feel, you know, alienated from other beings, but to feel this strong sense of identity. Community, connection. In order to remember through all your future lives, protect the teachings which have been given to you. Without the activated wish to awaken, the aspiring wish to awaken connected to it will not increase on its own to its full form. So he's also saying, and that, like, that sort of aspiring wish has to eventually turn into action. It has to turn into action for it to really be its full form. So the next part is to talk about, like, how to get it going. You know, not just aspiring, but activated. Therefore, out of a desire to increase the vow for full awakening, one should certainly take this vow. So he's talking here about the next part of the step shared with those of greater capacity in your addendum. We are now at 5b. Taking the vows of a bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is somebody who has that wish. Has that aspiring and activated wish. So the way that you seal it, you make it from something that you wish to do someday into something that you are now trying to do actively, is to take a vow. So the next part is on the vow. Therefore, out of a desire to increase the vow for full awakening, one should certainly take this vow. Someone who is keeping well one or another of the sevenfold freedom vows is entitled to take the vow. So this is kind of just technical. This is like, who's entitled to take bodhisattva vows? Well, you have to first have what they call freedom vows. Sevenfold means one day vow, lifetime lay man's vow, lifetime lay woman's vow, novice monk, novice nun, full monk, full nun. So one of those seven categories. Just FYI. And then he says, others are not entitled to take it. The Buddhas have spoken of seven kinds of freedom vows. The best of these is said to be the vow of a fully ordained monk. I'll have pure conduct. We're going to go through this pretty quickly. In accordance with the ritual given in the chapter on vowed morality in Master Asanga's stages of the Bodhisattva, the vow should be taken from a qualified guru who possesses all the proper attributes, one who is expert in the ceremony for giving the vow, who is himself or herself keeping the vow well, who is compassionate, and who is considered to be able to impart the vow. That is a qualified guru. This is who you can take the vow from. And if you try but cannot find a guru like this, another ritual for taking the vow will now be given. In a former life, when Manjushri was a being called Ambara Raja, he generated the wish to awaken. Here I'll set down clearly what is found in the Sutra of the Adornment of Manjushri's Buddha Field. So the next part is a ritual, is a vow ceremony that you can take on your own. So I won't ask everyone to take it. But now you've got it in front of you. We'll go through what it says. If you would like to take it on your own, it would be a really good thing to do. Doesn't hurt, right? Can't hurt. So listen to what you're supposed to do. In the presence of the protector, so this would be a good way to do this would be to set up a little altar in front of you and to think about like some really inspirational figure and maybe put a picture of or a statue or something like that in front of you. In the presence of the protector, I generate the wish for full enlightenment. Bodhicitta. I invite all the living beings whom I will free from their poor state. So you can imagine that all suffering beings from all sort of realms, all like corners of the universe, are here watching you, you know, witnessing your vow here, right? Beginning today and up until I reach awakening, I will not act with a mind afflicted by malice, envy, or jealousy. Malice means ill will. Ill will means wishing harm on others. Envy and jealousy are kind of the same thing in a way, although you could say envy is being unhappy about the happiness of others, and jealousy is being guarded about something that brings you happiness that you don't want to share with others. Okay? So you try to resolve here to not have a mind that's filled with thoughts like that. I will practice purity in conduct and will abandon ignorant desire and bad deeds, comma means especially sensual desires and bad deeds. Restrained by the vow of morality, I will imitate the Buddhas. And we talked about what the vows of morality were yesterday. Like, don't kill, don't steal, don't sleep with people you shouldn't sleep with, or you could do the kinder and gentler version that Cindy taught you, the positive version. I will not be eager to... This is a very interesting part of the vow. I will not be eager to obtain awakening in some quick way. Rather, I will stay until the very end, even if it's for the sake of only one single being. This is very typical, what they call bodhisattva vows. To say, I will stay behind in this suffering world until everyone else is out. I'll be the last one out of the building. You know? I will purify an inconceivable number of places. How does a person purify a place? You do some like magic, you put some like magic dust on it, say presto changeo. You purify it with your mind. You purify it by having a purified mind that then is in the presence of a place, that you bring into a place. See, there's no sacred places, actually. There's only sacred people in sacred places. I will purify an inconceivable number of places. The new name I will take will be known far and wide. So what does that mean? Like, everyone's going to know me, Marut, as being this awesome bodhisattva? Now, I heard this for many, many years from one of my teachers. Like, when you have a kind of a realization, you realize that when you have a realization of what it will be to be an enlightened being, an awakened being, you will know that they will not call you by your name. I heard that for many, many years going, like, why not? Why can't I be Buddha Sam? Or, you know, how come I have to be like, have to change my name or something like that? And I finally worked it out, I think. You won't be a particular person anymore. You see, when we have a name, we particularize things through our names. So you're just going to be Buddha. You're just going to be cosmos. You know, you're not going to be a particular thing. You're going to be all things and all beings. So in that sense, the new name that you have will be known far and wide, because it's the name that has no name. It's the nameless name. I will completely purify my actions of body and speech. I will cleanse the activity of my mind. I will no longer be the perpetrator of any non-virtuous acts. So, you know, you're kind of swearing this, like you would swear before testimony in court or something like that, with your hand on the Bible. You're trying to, like, you know, kind of really implant this intention strongly in your mind stream. If one exerts, so that's the ritual right there. You've got like, what, four or five verses that you can say. And it's very beautiful, very, very beautiful. And like I said, it doesn't hurt to. The thing about vows, for those of you who haven't taken vows, is that you will always break your vow. If you weren't subject to breaking your vow, you wouldn't need to take the vow. You see, so like some people restrain themselves from taking vows because, well, you know, I don't think I can keep it. Well, of course you can keep it. But you take the vow with the intention that you're going to try to keep it. And that's a lot stronger than saying, well, you know, I think I probably will try to be nice to other people. You say, no, I swear I will try to be nice to other people. You see, there's a difference, different power. All right, if one exerts oneself in the three ethical trainings by adhering to the rules, which are the very embodiment of the activated wish to awaken, the great respect one has for these trainings brings about the purification of one's own body and mind. So what are the three ethical trainings that they're talking about here? There's different interpretations of this in the commentaries. One is that the ethical training of body, speech, and mind, of your physical action, of your verbal, you know, kinds of statements, and of your thought. There's another understanding of the three ethical trainings. If one exerts oneself in the three ethical by adhering to the rules, which are the very embodiment of the activated wish, so some of you can maybe like guess what's coming. The three here would be restraining oneself from harming others, which is actually, you kind of back to the foundational scope. The foundational level, the steps shared with those of foundational level. Restraining, because that's at that level, really. So you're kind of reiterating that. But then secondly, creating virtue. Not just restraining yourself from harming others, but positively creating virtue. And this is a reference to what they call the six perfections. So then the third one would be working for others, which, you know, kind of informs the other two. I'm going to restrain myself from harming others because I'm working for their benefit rather than against it. And then I'm going to create virtue because I'm working for their benefit also. You see how the three? Okay, everyone got the three? Doesn't really matter. The second one's the one that we want to talk about. Creating virtue. If you look on the outline here, you'll see the next part, 5C on the addendum, living the life of a bodhisattva. So this is activated now, activated wish, not just aspiring wish, activated wish. So in this part of the text, he's making reference to living a life like someone who has that kind of change in mindset, that kind of like expanded sense of who he or she is. So the six perfections quickly. Number one, generosity. And if you think about these perfections, they all have to do with, like, learning to think about other people rather than yourself or as yourself. So generosity means that, you know, what can I give? What can I give to others? They sometimes say that generosity comes in four forms. Material generosity, you know? So you give your resources to other people. If people need money, you give them money, if you have it. If people, you know, need something to eat, you give them something to eat. They need something, place to stay, like that, right? Material. Then the gift of love, which means that, you know, kind of universally, that because you see all beings as yourself, you love them as yourself, right? Jesus said this, love your neighbor as yourself. Neighbor means all beings, all beings. Then the third one, the gift of the protection from fear. So that when people see you enter the room, they're not starting to cringe, going, what's he or she going to say to me? What are they going to do to me? You know, they've hurt me in the past, or, you know, got a reputation of hurt. So you are harmless in the world. When you walk into a room, people are instantly relaxed. They're not worried about what you're going to do or say to them, to hurt them. Then the highest one, they say, when it comes to generosity, is what? Yeah, the gift of Dharma, the gift of teaching, the gift of transmitting what you know to be true to others so that they can benefit from it too. Then the second perfection is the perfection of ethics. Vowed morality, sometimes they call it. Vowed morality. So ethics, as you see, informs every one of the three steps, three levels. Steps shared with those of foundational scope, with middle scope, and with higher scope. It's all, ethics is found in each one of those levels. You never like abandon ethics. You never go beyond ethics, okay? Because ethics is the truth. It's satya. It's the truth. It's the way it is, you see? It's the way it is in the sense that it's the way it should be. Anything that deviates from it is an aberration. Killing other people is an aberration. It shouldn't be that way. Stealing other people's stuff is an aberration. It shouldn't be that way, etc. So ethics. Then thirdly, the perfection of what I've translated here as tolerance. Sometimes it's translated as patience. So again, it's other-oriented, you see? So patience means, putting up with it. Putting up with other people. Putting up with other people, putting up with their foibles, because they're just like you. See, or you could even say stronger, they are you. You are them. See, putting up with their foibles. So another way that we're all alike, remember the two ways that we're all alike? No one wants to suffer, everyone wants to be happy, universally. There's a third way that we're all alike. I just made this one up. We're all alike in that we make mistakes. Yes or no? Anyone here not made a mistake? Anyone want to raise their hand and say, I never made a mistake? Oh, good. Because that would be your first mistake. So everyone makes mistakes. And when we make mistakes, we want other people to forgive us for them. We want other people to say, okay, I'll let it slide. So too do other people want you to let their mistakes slide. Yep. So patience means, tolerance means, among other things, it means recognizing that we universally are fallible and we don't always do what we know we should do. And other people are just like you in that way too. So give them a break. Patience. Then the fourth one is called joyful effort. It means the kind of getting stoked about doing the right things in life. Getting energized by your practice, by your spiritual practice, and bringing the same kind of excitement and energy and power to your spiritual practice that you bring to your professional life, for example. You know, people put up with all kinds of hardships to advance on the job, right? They lose sleep, they, you know, commute for hours in bad traffic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, why not be willing to do the same thing for something that's really going to pay off for you in life, your spiritual life? That's joyful effort. Then the other two are sometimes taken together. The last two, fifth and sixth, perfection of meditation and perfection of wisdom. And as we'll see, the rest of the text actually does bring these two together. Because meditation in and of itself is not virtuous. Okay? So much for the mainstreaming of meditation. No, I mean, it totally depends on what you're meditating on. If you're meditating on your breath, it will calm you down a little bit, but big deal. As soon as you're done meditating on your breath, you'll be all stressed out again, probably. So it doesn't really change you that much. If you're meditating on something that will transform you, then meditation becomes like a tool, like a laser beam, to cut through the the obscurations and the obstacles and so forth, so that you can really get at the juice of what it is that you're meditating on. So the highest form of meditation is the turning your mind single-pointedly, like a laser beam, on the nature of reality, which is wisdom. All right, so then we can pick up the text again, because now he starts talking about these two together. We'll start, the rest of the class today will be, this afternoon will be about the meditation part, and then tonight will be the wisdom part. Thus, because of one efforts in keeping one, verse 34 now. Because of one efforts in keeping purely and completely the vows of bodhisattvas, one completes the collections for full awakening. So he's saying, like, you know, you're moving now towards awakening, towards full Buddhahood. The two collections are called the collection of merit and the collection of wisdom. And they're called collections for one reason. Collection of merit, for example, is called the collection of merit and not a collection of karma, because merit and karma are different things. Karma is any action done with personal intention for a result. Okay? Personal intention, individual intention. Sankalpa. Any action that's done with sankalpa. I want this result from my action. That is karmic action. That will always result in a karmic effect. Action done in an impersonal or unpersonal, depersonal or omnipersonal way is merit. Omnipersonal means for all beings. I do this for all beings. Okay, that's the bodhisattva attitude. I am all beings. So all my actions is informed by that understanding of who I am. So it's a very special kind of an intention, not a personal intention. And that brings merit, not karma. Okay? That builds the store of merit that brings you eventually awakening and takes you out of the cycle of karma. All the Buddhas regard the cause for completing the collection of merit and wisdom to the development of higher knowledge. Abhijñā. And so there's a whole bunch of stuff here on higher knowledge. What is higher knowledge? These are known in the yoga world as siddhis. Siddhis, powers, supernatural powers. All the Buddhas regard the cause for completing the collection of merit and wisdom to be the development of higher knowledge. So in this text he's saying, look, if you want to get to Buddhahood, you got to get some ammo. You got to get some major, like, chops. You know, you got to get some, like, powers here. Just as a bird with undeveloped wings cannot fly, so too without the powers that come with higher knowledge, one is unable to fulfill the goals of living beings. So what is the purpose of these powers? The purpose of these powers is to fulfill the goals of living beings. How do you fulfill the goals of living beings? By awakening as all living beings. So what are the powers? What are you talking about, Abhijñāna? There's lists. Here's one of them. And, you know, I'm going through this because I have a point to make. Here's the point. I'll tell you what the point is before I even go through it. Do you have them already? The ability to do miracles, like what? Travel quickly from place to place. Have that one? Called airplanes, okay? No, I mean, like, this is a text that was written 1,100 years ago, 10,000 years ago. If you brought something, and this is very common in these kinds of texts, that at a certain level of practice, you have the ability to fly. You hear this also in the yoga texts, yeah? And so, like, you know, we think that what that would mean is to kind of go like this. Right? But as Cindy once famously pointed out, because I've repeated her insight many, many times, actually, if you got a power like that, and you started to fly, like, you know, all these insects would be hitting you, and your hair would get all mussed up, and, you know, your face would all be like, and you'd go, well, you know, maybe I should develop this a little bit better. Maybe I should develop this supernatural power a little bit better. I know. I'll fly while sitting down in a comfortable chair, that reclines back, and maybe I'll have a TV screen in front of me with like a whole bunch of channels and movies, and I'll have people bringing me foods and drinks. And wouldn't that be a better way to fly? I'm kind of serious, okay? Now, I had a big argument with some guy who ran a yoga studio in Ireland when I did this rap in Ireland. He said, no, they didn't mean technology. Like, well, what's wrong with technology exactly? Why couldn't it mean technology? If you brought somebody 1,000 years ago into our world and put them on an airplane, wouldn't they say, yeah, this is flying, actually? You know, I'm flying. You see, so we get hung up on the idea that it all has to be kind of like individual and physical or something like that. But you already have that ability. Knowledge of others' minds. Do we have that? I used to be stuck on this one, trying to figure out a modern equivalent of this. But how about texting? Isn't that kind of like instant knowledge of what other people are thinking? Clairaudience. Clairaudience means that you can hear things far away. Can you hear things far away? Through the, you know, television or the radio, can you hear things like that? Knowledge of past. So now this gets a little harder. Knowledge of past lives and stuff. So that one's a little trickier, I think, to find a modern equivalent of. Clairvoyance. Clairvoyance means knowing what's going on at a distance. We certainly have that, right? We know what's going on around the world at any time, pretty much. Right? If you go on CNN or something like that, you find out what's going on. Or if you don't want to just go, you know, you can find out what's going on with your friends around the world, right? Here's how you do that, okay? You pick up a little device like this, and you go, hello, Paris, what's happening? Isn't it? Instantaneous. Knowledge of the end of suffering. That's another kind of different, kind of hard one. You're getting this. We're all getting this by coming to the ashramite, you know, and learning what we're learning. Didn't used to be as common as this to get teachings like this. Used to be very difficult, very rare. Now it's very, very common. Here's another one that's sometimes mentioned in these kinds of contexts. Sarva jna. Sarva means all. Jna means knowledge. So we're talking here about abhijna, the higher knowledges. And one of the higher knowledges is what they call omniscience. And this one used to really throw me because, you know, I was in the academic world for most of my adult life. And, you know, you enter the academic world with the hope that you will become omniscient. Most people do. Like, you know, you'll know everything. And then, you know, you kind of quickly learn that you're never going to know everything about any particular subject. The more you know, the more you know you don't know, actually. So you know, how could anyone know everything? And then they invented the World Wide Web. So can we know everything? I mean, pretty much, almost instantaneously, you just go and Google it, and you can know pretty much anything, isn't it? I mean, it's not a fully developed city yet, but it's on its way. It's on its way to being a, you know, a full-on city. I talked to some people recently who worked at, one person who worked at Google. And she told me that, you're not supposed to tell people about what's going on at Google, by the way. Okay, so this is under wraps. But what I suspected is actually happening. What I've suspected for years, they are working on the chip that will go into your brain that will take you to the internet instantaneously. Yeah. The glasses are still on. Remember the glasses? I thought that they'd like abandon that project, but no, they're still coming. So that will be the kind of intermediate thing. Is that everyone will, you know, in 5 years maybe, everyone will come to the ashram with these glasses on. You know, the glasses, Google Glass they're called, right? Google Glass, and you know, you just kind of look up here. Where's Starbucks? You know, Starbucks is there. And, you know, what's happening on my website? Okay, over there. What's going on Facebook? You know, all just right here. And soon that will all be interiorized. Okay? So we will have instant access without a physical exterior mediation to the World Wide Web and everything that's in it. Now, is that sarvajna or what? Is that omniscience? I mean, a form of omniscience. Ah, yeah. Yep, yep, yep.
Huh? Do you think this is all this technology? This is what they really.
No, yeah, of course they had no idea about technology 1,000 years ago.
If you read about stuff like that, I mean, I haven't really, I just was dabbling into reading some of the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Yeah.
And they were talking about how they were really advanced. They already knew days in advance they could see their death was coming and they could actually see into the future and, the astral travel or the spiritual. If we're not physical beings, do we need to physically travel? If we are an energy or a spirit, then we don't need a physical manifestation.
I don't want to get into it too much. It's kind of, I'm kind of making a point. I'm not maybe totally literal here, but I'm trying to make a point that we have amazing powers that they used to talk about in the past already through technology. And you could also say that we have an energetic sort of identity also now through the internet, through our presence in the internet. We're moving in that kind of direction so that we will increasingly, be living in cyberspace. Now, is that just energy? Is that energy? What is cyberspace? Like I said, I don't want to, belabor the point a little bit. My main point only is that we are living in incredible times. Yeah. And so all of these, talk about abhijna, these amazing powers and stuff like that, we have at least some version of all of them, or of many of them anyway. And then the next point is, and what are we doing with them? You see, here in this context, it's all about using them as a kind of a springboard to achieve the ultimate state, the awakened state. Are we using them for that? Could we use them for that? See, the ability to communicate with people instantaneously is an amazing opportunity, to really help people, to really communicate, to really have this kind of, sense of interconnection. We live in a time where we've always been interconnected, but because of the technology, it's obvious that we're interconnected. Obvious, right? It can't be denied that we have this kind of network. We're living in a network of communication. So anyway, just interesting to think about. When the practitioner has achieved meditative concentration, I moved ahead too fast. Where are we? Awakening will succeed at gaining higher knowledge only by making efforts, not through laziness. Is that the next one that I haven't done yet? Yeah. One who wants to... this is 38. One who wants to quickly complete the collection necessary for full awakening will succeed at gaining higher knowledge only by making efforts, not through laziness. So, this is one of the times in the text where he emphasizes that the spiritual life requires work at every level. Yoga, it requires discipline. There's no connotation of yoga that means easy or lax or something like that. It always means some form of discipline. So what kind of lazinesses are there? In the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, they say laziness comes in two forms. One is the obvious one. I just don't feel like it. I just don't feel like doing meditation. I don't feel like, doing my yoga. I don't feel like studying sacred texts. I don't feel like trying to be a good person. I just don't feel like it. Too lazy. But there's another kind of laziness. I'm too busy. Busyness is a form of laziness. I mentioned it last night in the satsang. I've seen it many, many times in my life. There's one thing that I really have to do. I get really busy doing all the other things that I don't have to do. get all kinds of stuff accomplished. But that one thing, because I don't want to do that one thing. Too lazy to do that one thing. So, you know, this is the more common form, I think, of laziness in many people's lives nowadays. It's just keeping so busy all the time that they never kind of get around to doing what they know they should do. Without the attainment of meditative concentration, higher knowledge cannot arise. So now he's talking about the fifth perfection, meditative concentration. Therefore, one should repeatedly make efforts to attain meditative concentration. The word here is shamatha. Shamatha. A Sanskrit word that's becoming more and more anglicized. The attainment of meditative concentration. So how do you get meditative concentration? Swami Atma told us last night how to do it. How to get meditative concentration. Everyday practice. Practice. Right? And that mostly means, especially in the early stages of your practice, of sitting down regularly for 15 or 20 minutes, closing your eyes usually, and trying to keep your mind one-pointedly on a single object. Okay? That's called meditation. And best to have a beneficial object, a virtuous object, but it's good to have any object in order to sort of train the mind to keep it on an object. It also means in general, shamatha means in general, the kind of peace of mind that comes. Shamatha is a Sanskrit word that's related to shanti. Shanti, shanti, you know, peace. So shamatha in general means a peace of mind. Peace of mind that comes from not having the mind scattered and diverted by endless kinds of, sort of stimuli, interior or exterior. So regular, therefore one should repeatedly make efforts, yatna means, work at it, to attain meditative concentration, practice. One whose meditative concentration is incomplete will not achieve complete meditation. Complete meditation here is a translation of samadhi. Samadhi. So shamatha means this kind of ability to hold your mind concentratedly and with peace on an object. Then samadhi, translated here as complete meditation, means the ability to integrate fully into what's happening in the here and now. To integrate yourself fully into what's happening here and now. And not have this kind of distance, this sense of removal of me and what's going on in my world. It is kind of like self-consciousness that we go around with all the time. Therefore, following the 9 stages, I won't go into the 9 stages, they're just 9 stages of more and more intense concentration. Therefore, following the 9 stages discussed in the relevant chapter of Bodhibhadra's Collection for Complete Meditation, one should place the mind on some virtuous object or another. Punya, punya, means a meritorious object or another. So, what to meditate on. Here's a couple of suggestions, okay? I mean, most people, when they're first taught meditation, are taught to meditate on their breath, which is a very, very useful form of meditation. Very easy, relatively easy, because your breath is always there. You can still lose concentration on it very, very easily. But then if you're not breathing, you're in trouble. So you're breathing and it's there and you can return, the mind, the concentration to it over and over and over again. But that's very preliminary. That's a very preliminary form of meditation. That's just kind of like, that's kind of a dry run. That's kind of just practice for the real show. The real show is to put your object on something meritorious or virtuous. So one object like this would be the image of a being that you regard as perfect, and put your mind on that. And generally speaking, this is probably somebody like God, or Krishna, or Shiva, or Jesus. Or if you have a really high regard for him, Mahatma Gandhi or something. But not somebody that you're sitting around going, oh yeah, but they also had this fault. You know what I mean? So what you're doing is trying to match your mind to the image of perfection. which is in your mind. You see what I mean? So you're trying to put your mind on an image of something, of a being that you regard as perfect, so that it can kind of get into this feedback loop, so that your mind will then take the shape. Your mind takes the form of what it puts itself on. Okay, so if you're putting your mind, your concentration on something that you regard as perfect, your mind will take that form too. So that would be a good object to do. And then, like we'll talk about tonight, to put your mind one-pointedly on the fact that things cannot exist the way they seem to, in order to start penetrating the illusion. And the illusion is very thick. Is that the right term? It's powerful. It's very thick and powerful. So it takes that kind of laser-like concentration to even begin to kind of like break through the layers and layers and layers and layers of denial that we have about what is actually the case. Okay? Things do not exist the way they seem to. Things exist only impermanently, for example. Do they seem to exist moment by moment by moment, changing, nanosecond by nanosecond? No. They seem to have some permanence. Here's one that we'll do as a meditation tomorrow, just as a kind of an alert. The last meditation that we'll do tomorrow morning, I get to lead it. So I'll give you a little heads up on it. Everyone can start thinking about your irritating person. Okay? The irritating person. The first one that comes to your mind is the most irritating, almost certainly. Okay? So the first one that came to your mind when I said, your irritating person, you can start meditating on them now. It's like thinking about them, and then you can think like, why are they irritating? Like Swami Atma was saying last night, why do they irritate you so much? I mean, you know, it's useful kind of psychological analysis. You know, what do they do? What do they say? Why do I have the button in me that they can push? Okay? You know. And then tomorrow we'll do a meditation that will hopefully prove to you that an irritating person is an illusion. There are no irritating people. You know why? Why, you want to stay irritated forever? Okay, here's why. Here's how things really do exist, okay?
Are you going to do the meditation now?
No. No, it's not. I'm just talking.
You're going to remain irritated until tomorrow.
Yeah. And I did a whole rap. I've done many, many versions of this rap about how there are no irritating people and so forth. To an audience once, and at the end of the class, somebody came up to me and says, I find you to be an irritating person. When I say there are no irritating people, I mean by themselves. As irritating, as fundamentally irritating, as essentially irritating, as like with a tattoo, born to irritate. There are no irritating people like that. There can only be, ready for this? This is how things do exist. Things are empty of existing in any other way than this. That's what emptiness means. So here's how things do exist. An irritating person depends on you being irritated by them to be an irritating person. Okay? They can't be irritating all by themselves. They have to have an irritated person for them to be irritating. Well, I didn't say that exactly. Because you can't be irritated all by yourself either, right? I mean, you know, sometimes it seems like we are. But really, you need somebody to be irritating to be irritated.
But it's their behavior that's irritating.
Yeah, you are irritated by them. It's not their behavior is irritating without you being irritated. So they can't have like behavior that's just going like this until you go, that's very irritating what you do, what that thing you're doing. You see what I mean? That thing that you're doing is not irritating until you say, that's irritating. You see what I mean? All right, listen to the formula, okay? This is probably the last thing we'll do. There can be no irritating person without you being irritated. You can't be irritated without an irritating person either. Okay? So far, so good?
Yeah.
Oh, no, listen to this part. Okay, no, listen to this part. Neither can exist without the other. Okay? The irritating person can't be an irritating person without you being irritated, but you can't be irritated without the irritating person being irritating. Neither can exist without the other. Okay? Ready? Kate?
And neither can come first.
Neither can come first. See, if there was an irritating person that you then like encountered and said, "Oh, I'm irritated by you," that would be an irritating person that existed without you being irritated. And then you just like encountered them, and then you're irritated. See, they'd be all by themselves as an irritating person. Or if you were irritated all by yourself and then ran into an irritating person and were irritated, it would be an irritated person who could exist without an irritating person. Right? Neither can exist without the other, and neither can come first. And things, you know, to use the technical term, and things are empty of existing in any other way than that, which means everything is in interconnection. Everything exists in interconnection. Mutual dependency, interdependency, and nothing exists independently. Okay? Independently would be an irritating person who is irritating all by themselves. And I know that this is how we feel about our irritating people. We feel, of course, they're irritating. Everyone would find them irritating. Don't we? Do we say that?
Yeah.
Well, what's the proof against that? Some people don't find them irritating. And then we go, how could that be? I'm so confused. Wait a second. Let me tell you about how irritating they are. Right? Swami Atma was like referring to this old riff I had about if there was a, you know, I've done this many, many times, and people before the filter goes on that like prevents you from saying really stupid things, like sometimes people, they raise their hand and say, "I know somebody that everyone would find irritating." And which is exactly how we all feel about our irritating person. Everyone would feel, right? So it's like we would, you know, if we all got on a bus and took a field trip to the irritated, that would be an independently existing irritating person. We'd all just file by them and go, "Ooh, yeah, ooh, ooh, oh, ooh." Yeah? Universally, like everyone would find them irritating. The proof that there are no irritating people, all by themselves, right? There are no irritating people is that they have friends. They have family that loves them. They have like little kids who want to play ball with them. And you go, "What? Playing ball with them? What? Don't you? Like we want to like talk to their children about this?" You should find your father irritating. I find them irritating. Okay, no irritating person until and unless you're irritated. And no irritated person until and unless there's somebody that's irritating you. Each depends on the other. This is called interdependence. Each depends on the other. Neither can exist apart from each other. That would be independent. Independent irritating person, independent irritated person, who then just happened to come together maybe somehow. Neither can exist without the other, and neither one can come first. They have to happen at the same time. You can't have an irritated person without an irritating person. And you can't have an irritating person until and unless you're irritated. So, like, presto changeo. Maybe I'll have to do another meditation tomorrow. I already, like, spilled the beans on this one. So how do you get rid of an irritating person? Like, I gave Dr. Ian, like, a three-step process last night. But here's the one-step process. How do you get rid of an irritating person? All right, ready? Don't be irritated. She's seriously bumming. Which is entirely in your power. I mean, not entirely, but potentially in your power. Yeah. Hey, you could try that. That's been tried before, to tell you the truth. Yeah, you're not inventing the wheel here. No, if you're not irritated, they cannot be an irritated person. Okay, because they depend on you to be irritated for them to be an irritating person. And if you're not irritated, they simply cannot be an irritating person. You disappeared them. Easier said than done. Huh? Yeah. Easier said than done. But actually, ultimately, it's the only way to get rid of an irritating person. Okay? The only way to truly get rid of an irritating person is to figure out how not to be irritated by them. And one of the best ways to do that is to have some compassion for them. She's just thumbing out every which way. compassion. Shit, no. I should take her with every teacher. Take her in, though, as a plant. Yeah. Perfect. All right, look, guys, that's enough for today. Let's call it good.